podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
The following podcast is a member of the Great Big Owl family.
Football is many things. Unpredictable, exciting, colourful, passionate, absorbing, expensive.
Venal, infuriating, exasperating, time-consuming, depressing. But one thing it most certainly is not, is a level playing field.
Welcome to the famous sloping pitch. In a week where there were reports of a possible new refugee crisis, as hordes of foreign nationals spilled onto the streets of Manchester on Sunday, it was later revealed to be Manchester United fans flouncing out of Old Trafford to get earlier flights home.
It was also a week in which Arsenal were forced to deny that they've signed a four-year-old Instagram sensation. The kid has been dubbed Little Messi. But then we were all a little messy when we were 4 years old, weren't
Absolutely.
We?
Absolutely.
And dubbed is such a football thing, isn't it?
It is, isn't it?
Apparently he's only been playing at Arsenal's development centre with some Duplo, which has been dubbed Big Lego.
Marcus Rashford very nearly missed the Liverpool game with a dead leg. Nemanja Matic also missed out with a verruca. And Jadon Sancho forgot his kit.
And it was also a week in which Arsenal boss Mikel Arteta claimed that ex-players and coaches are being put off going into management jobs because of the abuse that managers get. Yeah, shut up, G.I. Joe, you Velcro-haired freak. Anyway, let's take a moment before we lower ourselves into the warm, soothing, relaxing, gently bubbling luxury jacuzzi that is the Premier League to dip our knackers tentatively into the rusty tin bath with a couple of inches of ice-cold water that someone just farted in that is the very bottom of the EFL. Oldham Athletic snagged a goalless draw away at Carlisle United, one of now three teams below us. We are, though, just 1 point off the very bottom again, thanks to a surprise win for previously reliable gold dump Scunthorpe United. Our next four games, well, they're against teams in the top six, so 21st may just represent something of a high watermark. We'll just have to wait and see. But a goalless draw is not a bad result when you consider that for some reason we've neglected to take the simple step of acquiring any strikers at all. Mm-hmm. Now, there's two little stories about Oldham this week that give you an insight into how the clown show is being directed. Firstly, there was that EFL charge over some outstanding transfer money not being paid to another club. We couldn't work out which of our free transfer and loan-heavy squad had actually been acquired with a fee of any kind. Well, whoever it was, apparently that's been paid off now, so that's one thing. That charge no longer
hanging over. It's not 20 tracksuits like the Tony Cascarino transfer to Gillingham.
And a sack of footballs.
Yeah.
But then the second thing came up, which is an issue with Oldham not paying Rochdale the ticket money they owe from the recent match at Spotland, and the EFL are apparently having to withhold money from Oldham's next payout to cover this. But it does answer the question, where did they get the money to pay off the outstanding transfer fee? You see, the clans, they're like gamblers taking out new credit cards every month to pay off the outstanding amount on the old ones. And things have reached such a pitch of disillusionment that Oldham fans this week have actually been expressing jealousy about Bury and Rochdale and Wrexham and Stockport. Bury, you'll remember, went out of business a few games into the 2019-20 season, were expelled from the league altogether. Heartbreaking scenes outside Gig Lane, which was put up for sale by the administrators, and supporters fear the worst. Of course, superstores, flats, neglect, grass waist high, like at Plough Lane. I remember going past Plough Lane.
Yes.
And the grass was actually, you know, up to your chest.
Yeah, and you can still visit Third Lanark, which the ground is still there, yeah.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Well, now, apparently in Bury, supporters group Est 1885 plans to buy the ground by Christmas and get the club back into the pyramid in time for 2022-23, which is great, except that they've already formed a Phoenix club, Bury AFC, which plays at Radcliffe in the North West Counties First Division North, which is the 10th tier. So it's all pretty messed up. The local derbies with themselves.
Can I ask you, when did the Football League become a pyramid? Because there used to be Football League ladders, didn't there?
There must be
a different shape now.
Well, I think there's ladders 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, there's ladders, and then it splits north-south tier 6. So there's two tier 6 divisions.
Right.
And then below those, there are three, I think, feeders into those.
So it's more like a ziggurat.
Which is a pyramid, of course.
Yeah, it's kind of pyramid.
Yeah, it's almost exactly the same.
Apart from the fact it's a little bit different. Let's not fall out, Chris, for goodness sake.
Anyway, look, here's Bury planning North West County's First Division local derbies against themselves, and Oldham fans are actually muttering, you know, lucky bastards, because at least it feels like there's something to look forward to, you know.
Yeah.
And at Rochdale, the same thing. The fans group, the Dale Trust, have managed to see off some dodgy-looking outside investment, and we're going, how did they do that?
Oh, no.
And Stockport have just been bought by a local boy made good. You know, I'm very jealous of that.
Well, that's a thing, Stockport envy, isn't it? That's been done before.
Yeah. Stockport envy. That's right. And actually, the Rochdale guy said this: look at our peers. Look along the M62. Bradford, Huddersfield, Halifax, Bury, Bolton, Wigan, Stockport.
No!
And it didn't mention Oldham at all. And for decades, the idea that Rochdale would consider Oldham as a peer would have been laughable, because for most of the 70s and 80s and 90s, we're at least two divisions above them. But we're in League Two now. We're just below them. How dare they miss us out? Oh. I mean, you know, granted, you have to cross the M62 rather than go along it, because we're only 6 miles away, and we have been in administration, so we're in the club.
Yeah. So Oldham are the Trotsky of the M62. Forgotten.
Yeah, and there's Wrexham, of course. This week, their new Hollywood owners turned up. Ryan Reynolds and Rob McElhenney watched their club for the first time, losing away at Maidenhead. Mm-hmm. So, you know, welcome to football. She's a fickle mistress.
She said he is.
But then Oldham fans are wondering, can we get Bernard Cribbins and Nick Grimmy Grimshaw to buy the club? And if not, why not? Anyway, we'll move on to... just last night there was the Carabao Cup, unfortunately.
Well, I know that because I went to see Stoke lose to Brentford.
Well, you know, and other teams have lost to Brentford. At least you didn't lose by seven.
No.
You know. Man City lost on penalties last night to West Ham. And it's the first time they've lost in the League Cup for 5 years.
Yeah.
It wasn't even the Carabao Cup last time somebody else won.
Was it the Rumblows Cup?
I think it was unsponsored. I think they hadn't come...
No.
They hadn't even come up with the concept of sponsorship the last time someone else won.
No, that can't be true.
Yeah, no, it was just the EFL Cup. And Man United won it. They beat Southampton in 2017.
Well, I remember that, because Southampton probably should have won, shouldn't they? Yeah. They had a goal disallowed. Who was that Italian striker that they brought in?
Whose
sister plays for the Italian women's team and looks quite like him. I'm not making no judgment. I'm just saying. She's his sister, after all.
Well, they're both lookers. There you go.
Yeah.
And there was also a Liverpool game last night.
Mm-hmm.
Where Divock Origi scored a goal, the like of which I've never seen, and I've seen way too much football over the decade, so it's quite hard to surprise me. But check it out if you haven't seen it. There was a caption in the paper under a picture of this goal happening, and it looks like Origi has just headed it, and the caption goes, "Heading through," heading through to the next round of the Carabao Cup. But in fact, what he's done is he's back-heeled it up and over his own head. And it was an astonishing thing. But the caption writer of the paper clearly didn't see the goal.
He thought it was a header.
He just saw the still and thought, well, that's obviously a header.
And Divock Origi, of course, Divock, another footballer named after Star Trek character. Divock definitely would be the prince of somewhere.
Well, he'd be a Vulcan, probably, would he?
Oh, he could well be. Yeah.
So onto the big money league. I mean, there's only one place really we can start this week.
Yeah.
I mean, Manchester United found the ideal way to commemorate the 10th anniversary of the shattering 6-1 home defeat by Manchester City by staging an equally shattering, if not slightly more so, 5-0 home defeat by Liverpool. I watched this on Sky and then again on Match of the Day because it was funny. I had it recorded because I was out, so I was doing a bit of a...
I ruined it for you, didn't I?
I
was sending you messages.
Oh, my phone was buzzing away like crazy. I had an inkling that it was going to be interesting, but I couldn't switch it on and see.
Yeah, well, thank goodness nothing had happened to any of your boys then turning your phone on. Oh. I don't wish it, but
But as you say, thank goodness. But amazing that when you watch it on Match of the Day, that the highlights featured... Oh, it's a near miss by United. Goal by Liverpool. Another near miss by United. Oh, goal for Liverpool. Another goal for Liverpool. Managed to make the game seem almost even. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
It was just...
Yes.
It wasn't the game that I just watched, where Liverpool had like 84% of the ball.
Yeah.
And Manchester United never looked like being in the game. Never looked like being in the game.
And, you know, at the risk of falling into the same trap and not talking about Liverpool, but talking about United, you obviously saw the incredible Ronaldo kicking out episode down near the byline.
Well, yeah, I did. I mean, and just this game writ large was the race to be Premier League Player of the Month.
Well, yes,
between
of
Salah and Ronaldo, still too close to call, I think.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
Salah scored three, but they were all defensive errors. Ronaldo scored the best goal of the game, which was unfairly disallowed.
That's right.
And then he lost his rag, didn't he? Yeah, and tried to kick the ball through Curtis Jones's spine.
That's right. Well, the Premier League, I'll come back to the kicking the ball through Curtis Jones's spine as I feel I have to. But the thing about the Premier League Player of the Year was that obviously there's been quite a lot of criticism of the Premier League, and you know, and they've responded by saying, look, it's not about money. It's not about the fact that Ronaldo raised the profile of the Premier League. Mm. You know, we are not about money. We are about football. And you know, this next October Premier League Player of the Month, they're thinking it's going to be somebody outside of the top six, and the current favourite is Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor of the Exchequer.
Good.
the reason that the Ronaldo kicking out thing interested me is it's slowly become evident to me that this idea of the referees letting more go, right? There's been no description of what things should be let go. Mm. They just seem to have a quota. You know, that every third foul, that's fine. Yeah. It doesn't matter what it is. It's fine.
Yeah, well, you know, I've been organising and playing football, amateur football, for where someone in the game has to referee the game. I've refereed games that I've played in for years and years and years, and I've developed over the years a very laissez-faire system where I don't give a free kick for anything.
Yeah.
Whatever happened, not deliberate handball, nothing.
No.
Because if you give one free kick, then you're giving free kicks every couple of minutes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people then
not
learn
even treason.
Treason. Well, death penalty for treason, obviously. Oh, yeah, but, yeah, that. But no, the Ronaldo thing was interesting because you could see, he kicked the ball, but the ball was right up against Curtis Jones. And in fairness, if he'd managed to kick it right through Curtis Jones, he'd have been clear through on goal. So, you know, really, mm-hmm. Jones is lucky not to be sent off for denying him a clear goal-scoring opportunity with his internal organs.
Yeah.
But anyone else, you have to feel that anyone else would have been sent off. Mm-hmm. You know, imagine if Fred had done that.
Yeah.
You know, if Fred had done it, the United fans have been calling for him to be sent off, probably. But
Or do you imagine if James Tarkowski had done it? Yeah. You know, that's the worry, isn't it?
Yeah. Or Ryan Shawcross.
Well,
let's say
Ryan wouldn't have done.
Yeah, exactly. But I thought Paul Scholes came out of it all quite well, didn't he? He became a meme, I think, as the kids say. And last midweek, when United played so poorly against Atalanta in the first half, he said if they play like that against Liverpool, they'll be 4-0 down at half time. And they did do, and they were. Which only makes me take Paul Scholes' judgment even more seriously. Yeah. I mean, he was already right up there on account of leaving Oldham after 31 days as manager, and as we said last week, naming Frankie Bunn as his favourite player. But really, this was quite amazingly sort of prescient for a former United. You know,
it was
showing
great.
Up his contemporary Gary Neville, who seemed baffled by the whole experience, and as though the thing had been laid on particularly to take the piss out of
it
him.
It was a personal affront,
a personal
Gary,
slight
wasn't it?
To Gary
yes,
Neville.
Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, surprised he bothered turning up for the wrap up of the show. Yeah. I see that. I mean, obviously, Solskjaer's under a certain amount of pressure in the way that we know that it works in football. But I've been looking at Manchester United managers other than Alex Ferguson.
Yeah.
And actually Solskjaer fits in quite well. If you look at Frank O'Farrell, Tommy Doherty, okay, won the FA Cup. Dave Sexton, Ron Atkinson, David Moyes, Louis van Gaal, Mourinho and Solskjaer. You know, what they're saying is, since Matt Busby, we've had Alex Ferguson and nobody
and nothing,
else.
Nothing else.
You know, by their standards, with the FA Cup now no longer meaning anything because they sold it out.
Yeah, and Mourinho, of course, won the Europa League, didn't he, I think, which is similarly diminished in people's minds as an achievement.
Yeah.
I mean, and he was in the amusing advert that he does, he makes more play out of being second in the league than winning the Europa League.
Yeah, he does.
But it was interesting to look back at, because it was the 10th anniversary of United losing 6-1 to Man City, which I remember having the great pleasure of watching with a Man United supporting radio producer after just doing a radio recording. Mm. But that was the Balotelli Why Always Me game.
Yeah, I remember it very
which
well.
Was the day after he'd set fire to his house by letting fireworks off in his bathroom.
Yeah, well, that could happen to anybody.
It could. And there was a list on the I think the BBC website, they put this list up of games that, you know, Manchester United's darkest days in the Premier League. And they're all in October. They're all October, yeah. They lost 5-0 to Newcastle in October 96 and then won the title. They lost 5-0 to Chelsea in 99 and then won the title. They lost 6-1 to City and in 2011. And the thing that I hadn't realised was that they lost the league to City on goal difference at the end of that season.
Mm-hmm.
And if that game had been 2-1 instead of 6-1, then their records would have been absolutely identical and there'd have been a playoff.
Not a toss of the coin?
You'd want a toss of the coin.
You would, actually. In that particular instance, you'd love a toss of the coin. Wouldn't you like to see the crowd turn up for the toss of the coin? Yeah. That would be a fantastic thing.
And, yeah, and have the toss of the coin on Match of the Day. Yeah. Alan Shearer say, oh, he should have called heads.
Yeah. Well, he's called heads. He hasn't shown us yet. I've got to say that heads has lost 6 of the last 7 times. There was a thing in the paper today saying that 9 Manchester United players had approached Antonio Conte to become the new manager.
Did you see?
9 they were. Ronaldo, Pogba, Varane, Telles, Fernandes, Martial, Sancho, Greenwood and Rashford. And you wonder, so how did they approach him? Did they go to his house and shout, oh, Antonio, we need your help? I love the idea that Mason Greenwood's one of them. He's 20 years of age.
Well, did they knock on his door and go, trick or treat?
Yeah.
And while we're here, since we're here.
Like the idea, it's like the Magnificent Seven, you know, the villagers calling in the gunslinger to come and help them out. But Mason Greenwood, as I say, is 20. He's got to phone up Conte and say, hello, Mr. Conte, you don't know me. My name's Mason Greenwood. But we're having a lot of trouble in our football club.
And also the cat's done a whoopsie in my beret.
Of course. Can I just give you one fact from this weekend, which came from my Watford correspondent, Ollie Wicken from Hornet Heaven, which is Watford, who won at Everton on Saturday.
Yes.
Did you know, you probably did, that their last 5 Premier League away wins have all been under different managers. Gracia, Sanchez, Flores, Pearson, Munoz and Ranieri. That's staggering, isn't it?
Well, Ranieri slid right down the sack race betting, hasn't he?
Yes.
2 games in.
Yeah.
Because he was second favourite after 1.
Yeah.
After 1 game. But they look good, actually. And Josh King looked like a man reborn. He's always been good, hasn't he?
I mean,
it was a mystery that he didn't score goals when he was at Everton. Wow. And they didn't really use him very much.
Yeah. Well, and talking to sackings, I mean, obviously, we did speak about Steve Bruce last week, but you just wonder, you know, Newcastle's new owners, they must have wondered what they've let themselves in for, you know, with the lack of process, the summary justice, the baying for blood. they can't have seen that before in Saudi Arabia, can they?
No, they're probably. But anyway, yeah, what about Solskjaer? There was initially, wasn't there, a determination to keep him quite forcefully after this 5-0, but that seems to have transmuted over the last few days into he's got 3 games to save his job, the Spurs, Atalanta, and then City, God help him, before an international break that would give them a theoretical fortnight to find someone new. But then that also includes the sort of waiver. If he loses to Spurs, he might be out anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the good thing is they can keep him in what they call the United family, and looking so young, he could easily be a ball boy. Very easily.
I mean, the 5-0 seems to have thrown a bit of a sort of forensic spotlight on how things are set up at Old Trafford, doesn't it? I mean, I hadn't quite perceived that Solskjaer himself regards himself as like a general manager more than, leaves the tactical stuff to his staff, who are quite inexperienced, apart from Mike Phelan.
So what does that mean that he does?
Well, he's like a figurehead.
Okay.
You know, and you'd think, you know, the assumption always is that, you know, the manager goes in at half time and it's here's a very important 15 minutes for Ole Gunnar Solskjaer to up and stuff
but
like
that. Do
that. But I don't think that that's really his.
So he's like Prince William at the FA.
Yeah, in lots of ways. I mean, it's hard for him. You know, he's been there for so many years. It's hard to believe he's lost the dressing room. But, you know, all the corridors look the same.
Oh, my word!
But the difficulty for Solskjaer is the hole he's dug for himself, really, is by being allowed to buy so many star players. They've spent £400 million on star players like, you know, Varane and Pogba and Fernandes and Maguire and Ronaldo. And managing these sort of egos is a different game to trying to G up a bunch of lads who are not quite up to it. You know, what he's left doing, Solskjaer, is shoving them out there to win games by individual brilliance.
Well, and actually, if you look at the Ferguson model, and I'm not sure that it was necessarily worked out like this, he came to success by bringing a load of youth players through who he had absolute control over, rather than, and this had been the United model for years, buying and buying and buying. I mean, United, you know, Gary Birtles, Davenport, Robson, etc., etc., etc. So you do wonder if it's, you know, if it's a great, if you haven't had a great deal of success as a manager to then bring in players like that, it must be quite difficult. I don't know if it is difficult, but it seems like it might be.
Well, you can see watching them that there are players there who are not hiding their dissatisfaction with their teammates, with how their teammates are playing. Ronaldo is obviously the most eye catching, but he's been spitting feathers. You can see, and it was interesting that Chiellini said it would have been better if Ronaldo had left Juventus earlier.
Juventus have really come.
And I think Juventus. The feeling with Juventus was that they were a team. And then Ronaldo came, and then they weren't a team, and now Ronaldo's gone, and they're a team again. You know, they play as an 11, and rather than trying to funnel everything through Ronaldo and dealing with Ronaldo's dissatisfaction when a ball isn't on a plate or when it isn't, happening. And you look at, you only need to look at Ronaldo. It's showing like open frustration with Greenwood, who he's supposed to be playing with on the right. I mean, obviously Greenwood's distracted by calling Antonio Conte, or thinking about it. But Solskjaer has been influenced by the status of the players. Into, you feel, bringing Maguire back too early after being injured.
Definitely,
and he's had a terrible week because he's just not fit. He's clearly not fit, and but he's a star player, and they've spent 70 million on him or whatever. And you feel like, oh, well, we need him back as soon as possible. He's come back too soon.
And what does that say to the other players who you know are in your squad to fill in when he's injured?
To Eric Bailly, for instance.
Yes.
Solskjaer's representing a certain continuity, of course, because he's one of Fergie's old favourites, and the thinking, I think, is that he'd be able to remember what Fergie did and then do that. But what Fergie did, I think, was surround himself with strong, experienced coaches like McLaren and Carlos Queiroz and Merlinstein and Walter Smith, who died this week. Solskjaer hasn't really done that. He's kind of got there was Carrick, who's become technical director now somehow.
And Fletcher's there now, isn't he?
Well, Fletcher's going to step in, I think.
Yeah.
And there's Mike Phelan, but he doesn't really listen to Mike Phelan, apparently.
But the other thing is that, you know, yes, Solskjaer was one of Ferguson's favourites, but not in his first team.
No, he was on his bench.
Generally,
exactly, on his bench, I mean, there was a great shot of Fergie, wasn't there, the calamity was unfolding. You know? They must have a camera fixed on him the whole time, hoping he's going to look pleased or better, disappointed. You know? And he never lets you down, does he? He's very expressive. And sooner or later, he's going to pull a face like he did on Sunday, like he's just laid a massive dump. And he's wondering, is that it, or do I have to stick around for more? You know? And the camera, they had a camera locked on Dalglish, obviously, as well. Have you never seen him looking so happy?
It's a low bar.
I know, but he looked like Stan Laurel being tickled in Way Out West. I mean, it is an era, isn't it, where the manager's role, we've said this before, is stupidly over important. And, you know, big matches are pitched as it's Klopp against Guardiola and it's Tuchel. And it's this. And the top three teams, particularly, have these superstar managers, these superstar wizard technicians, tacticians. And Solskjaer just isn't that, is he? He just doesn't seem to be that. And it seems like he doesn't regard himself as that. He doesn't define himself in that way. And he doesn't have that sort of charisma,
yes, I agree with you, but honestly, for somebody of our age, for me, apart from the Ferguson years, this is exactly how I remember Manchester United being the time. Loads and loads of expensive players who aren't really delivering what they ought to do.
Yeah, no, it's true. That's been a lot of Manchester United's history. And you think, if they do get rid of Solskjaer, who could they get? Because Ronald Koeman's available, you know?
Yes.
And he's got Premier League experience, international status, name recognition, and he's just taken one of the European Super League giants to ninth in the league. He sounds perfect.
Yeah.
It was probably, I think, a bad week for Paul Pogba to launch his vegan, gender-neutral football boots that he's designed Stella McCartney, who I'm guessing did most of the heavy lifting. She's like the Scott McTominay of that partnership. But this boot is called, Christ, the Adidas Predator Freak, because nothing says vegan like the word predator.
Exactly. What is going on there? And what was the other thing? It was non-gender specific.
It's their vegan, gender-neutral football boots.
It's a gender-neutral football boot.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, during his brief cameo on Sunday, his gender-neutral vegan boots looked, I have to say, both masculine and carnivorous as they as they made mincemeat out of Nabi Keita's shin. Yeah. I mean, in what sense is it vegan? I mean, people can eat these things.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
It's bad enough when people drink champagne out of boots, like Daniel Ricciardo when he wins a Grand Prix.
Yeah, it's just adding a word to something in the hope that it makes it different. It's like, you know, you come down to London, you see, you know, artisanal bread, and you think, well, I don't really know what that is.
It's something from the country, yeah. And well, in the big city, you know, we're impressed by that.
And then one of my favourites I often see as I walk down from Euston to do this very programme is bespoke sandwiches. In other words, you ask for a sandwich and they give it to you.
And they give it to you.
Yeah, they make it.
Not that they stick a bit of a bike in it. I mean, Pogba's quote was, it combines my love of football with, with my passion for style, again, arguably.
Yeah.
Like much that happens in the world of fashion, these things completely pass me by. They look horrible. They're like pointy, wedge-shaped, white with bluish splodges on, like a sort of couple of lumps of out-of-date Stilton.
Is he a vegan?
I don't think you have to be to wear the boots.
I suppose not. Know? No, it's a broad church.
Anyway, let's leave Manchester United to one side temporarily.
And go to David Beckham.
No. We'll do David Beckham in a minute. I mean, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia picked up its first point in the Premier League on Saturday at Crystal Palace. And they celebrated by announcing a U-turn. Yes. And I bet Steve Bruce's ears pricked up when he heard that. Having asked fans to refrain from wearing traditional Arabic clothing or Middle East-inspired head coverings for fear of causing offence, they reversed, or rather clarified, their position, saying that fans should feel free to welcome their new overlords by going right ahead and mocking their funny ways.
You say that, Chris. You see, what I'm thinking is, here we have the calming influence of, you know, your Geordie army. They've already persuaded this Saudi Arabian cabal to overturn their beliefs on tea towels. Next thing you know, it's going to be women's rights, LGBT, thank you very much.
And the world will be a happier place.
That's right. And Saudi Arabia will be like the big market.
Now, this club statement said, those who wish to support the club by wearing appropriate culturally inspired clothing should feel free to do so as they see fit. We're inclusive to all. Newcastle United FC and its new owners continue to support the Premier League's initiatives on diversity and inclusion, including no room for racism. Now, why would you say that?
Yeah, yeah.
If the tea towel thing wasn't at least on the dangerous edge of being racist. Yes.
And isn't it a wonderful thing when, you know, a group of strangers allow you to wear what you want.
Absolutely.
What's it going to do with them? Well, it's got nothing to do with them, what you're wearing.
But do you not think that they should have waited? They should have waited for this approval before they did it in the first place.
I suppose so.
I mean, one thing, though, it's great news for tea towel sellers across the Tyneside area, mm-hmm. especially, I imagine, those guys who knock on your door with a tray of shit they've got from the pan store. It must be like Christmas for them.
Yeah, yeah.
Which
yeah.
gets earlier every year, doesn't it? It's mm-hmm. like their last-minute nativity play costume bonanza come early.
Yes, absolutely. There's loads of kids going to primary school, and they're saying, but where's my shepherd's outfit. It's my bloody shepherd's outfit. Never mind you.
I'm off the game. And you know, those guys, you buy one overpriced thing from him because he looks a bit malnourished and as though he might stab you for a biscuit. And ever after that, it's like you're on some sort of mugs list, isn't it?
Yeah, you see this?
You notice more and more of them coming to your door and not to your next door neighbour. Oh, no. They skip straight off to the next mug who lives maybe 10 doors down.
Well, they put those chalk marks, don't they, on the gateway?
Do they?
Yeah.
And time is money in the door-to-door Middle East-inspired head covering flogging business.
Absolutely, of course it is. Of course it is.
And speaking, as we were, of morally questionable financial alliances, David Beckham, mm-hmm. as you alluded to a moment ago, the former pant model and part owner of Salford City, long ago dubbed Golden Balls, mm-hmm. Has become, of all things, an ambassador for the Qatar World Cup. Mm-hmm. Mystifyingly, this is a 10-year deal for $15 million a year. Yeah. And the tournament is a year away. What's he going to do for the other 9 years? You know, bang on about how great it was. Is that really worth $15 million a year to anyone? They must be expecting a hell of a lot of fallout that's going to need smoothing over with a gently smiling face and a soft cockney accent.
Yes, definitely.
Now, talk about how it's going to be great for a year, go to some games, talk about how great it was for another 9 years, 150 million smackers, job done.
Well, most of the stuff I read about it was fairly heavily critical of David Beckham's moral choices. Yeah. But there was one article, which presumably somebody had really lent on them, which said, no, it's good because David's already got them to agree that they're allowed to have rainbow flags at the game.
Yeah.
And also, almost a quote, don't forget he's married to Victoria Beckham and she was part of the instigator of girl power. So you see, that kind of makes an all right. And you've got to remember Qatar. Well, one, I think it's terrible that they're picking on David Beckham when they should just be picked on anyway, Qatar, from the moment they got the World Cup.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, they've got racism, they've got homophobia, they've got misogyny. Heaven knows, this is a country that employed Andy Gray and Richard Keys.
And save them from the scrap heap.
Yes, so, you know, which is even worse.
But no, Qatar have a horrible record on human rights, and so many migrant workers have been killed constructing the stadium.
Have just died.
constructing the stadium that, as you pointed out last time, were designed
Albert Speer,
Junior. And homosexuality is illegal there, much as it was in original Albert Speer's day. And the LGBT plus community is very upset because Beckham apparently is a gay icon.
Well,
because of the pants.
Well, exactly so. Now, it said, one of the articles that I read, that it's possible in Qatar to be thrown in jail for looking like you could be gay, which seems to me, I can't imagine how that law is worded. And also, you can imagine David turns up in his sarong, he might be in trouble there.
Not
that I'm making any generalisations.
Well, he's supposed to have got assurances, isn't he, that no one's going to be persecuted during the World Cup for being gay.
Yeah.
Or, as you say, looking a little bit gay.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, you can imagine somebody about to do some persecuting and somebody just shouts out, remember David Beckham? They go, oh, sorry, entirely my mistake.
Or they just go, golden balls.
Yeah.
You know, that's going to solve it, isn't it?
There's what I loved about his trip last week, because this is how it all came out, that it was described as a fact-finding mission, which I thought was a great thing for David Beckham to go on. And you can imagine Victoria going, David, hello, it's Victoria, how's your fact-finding mission going? And David goes, it's been brilliant. Did you know, Victoria, did you know a dolphin isn't even a fish? Did you know that? And the battle of Magna Carta was at lunchtime, about 12:15.
Yeah, cash finding mission more like that.
Yeah.
Well, the thing about old Golden Balls is he's, as we know, he's a skilled propagandist in his own right. We were talking the other week about that Fever Pitch thing, the propaganda documentary made by his company about the Premier League, which featured shots of him smiling enigmatically like a model in sort of expensive looking locations, but not actually saying anything at all.
No.
Just smiling like, oh, the Premier League was good, wasn't it?
Mm.
And all being subtextual in that little half smile.
Well, he's like the silent movie star whose voice is ridiculous, who then does one or two films in the talkie era, but never says it.
There you go.
Yeah. That's one of... Do you know, the reason that he has a link with Qatar is because obviously he played for Paris Saint-Germain and became very good friends with Nasser Al-Khelaifi, who was the man, by the way, who employed Richard Keys and Andy Gray. But There was a very good phrase.
There are many charges on the list.
Yeah, there was a very good phrase that I read, which was like something from a Famous Five novel, which said that him, David Beckham, and Nasser Al-Khelaifi had been seen laughing together. And I like that. They're going, it's a diabolical laughter.
Well, yeah, and Beckham, of course, was implicated in a negative way, you know, with the power of his brand, by failing to bring the World Cup here during the same shonky bidding process that took it to Qatar in the first place.
Yep.
Because Sepp Blatter lumped the two together, as we've discussed already, the 2018 process and the 2022 process, because he was worried that he might die before he was able to cash in and milk the world of football one last time. And yet he's still alive. So that's another thing he got wrong, like the ladies playing in hot pants thing.
But
Beckham's global icon status was, you know, not up to it, and possibly dragged down by being attached to Prince William and David Cameron.
I don't understand what you're saying. Remember, he's married to Victoria Beckham, and she started Girl Power.
But yeah, there should be more Girl Power involved in the World Cups. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah.
But, yeah. Anyway, so several times since we started doing this thing, whatever it is, we've discussed the business of marginal gains.
We have.
Football exploring ways to take very small advantages, you know, baby steps forward. Last week we talked about the gloriously named Soccerbot 360, the all-round system for replaying match situations to improve scanning and spatial awareness that was being pioneered at Norwich. And you have to say it didn't seem to help them on Saturday against Chelsea. Maybe they had the whole thing set up all week to Lukaku mode and they overlooked the threat of, you know, everyone else.
Yeah.
And maybe it was when the pictures turned into actual real opposition players the Norwich lads were confused.
Well, you've got to think that the people who manufactured the Soccerbot 360 were a bit gutted on Saturday.
A bit gutted, yeah, because it had come out and then the very next... But all the players, you know, in the game looking for the... How many lives do I get? Can I respawn?
Yes. Yeah.
And we've mentioned the emphasis on statistical analysis at Brentford, the so-called Moneyball thing.
Yeah.
The specialist throw-in coach at Liverpool, Thomas Gronemark, who they got from Brentford. And many clubs now have set-piece coaches, or restart coaches, as they sometimes style themselves.
Oh, dear.
Well, now there's a new specialist coach on the block. It's quite interesting, I think, down at AFC Wimbledon. And his name is Sammy Lander, and he's a substitution coach. As he says, one of these guys could be your match winner. Now, he came up with this notion himself, apparently, and as part of his pitch to persuade the AFC Wimbledon manager to take a punt, he analysed the behaviour of the England subs at the Euro final against Italy. And obviously this is an extreme example, given that the two subs who came on, Rashford and Sancho, came on specifically to take penalties in the shootout. But he points out that they were out warming up for about 11 minutes, not jogging up and down the touchline, just walking. Mm-hmm. For about 7 minutes, they were just stood still. Mm-hmm. They did a couple of minutes of groin stretches, and then for about a minute, they sat down. Yeah. And so he's wondering whether they were physically prepared to enter such an intense game of football.
Yeah, the funny thing is, you know, he's really cool, but actually, that's kind of a really sensible thing.
Kind of is. And you know, the more you. One of the things that's interesting about this is what the AFC Wimbledon manager thinks about it, which we'll come to in a moment. But. It's where he thinks he can add value by getting players technically, physically and mentally ready to enter a game, creating finishers, like super subs, in effect.
And
we've known, you know, historically in football, all the way back to, you know, David Fairclough, that there are players who are temperamentally disposed to do well coming on into a game.
All the way back to Keith Peacock, the very first substitute.
And, you know, sometimes, the notion of bringing on a speedy player against tired defenders, you know, it makes a lot of sense. What the difficult thing is persuading the player that's the role they should be aiming to fill. You know,
the professional game is definitely a step ahead already of the amateur game in terms of the substitutes. I mean, you very rarely try to bring a player on and he's back in the change room having a piss. That very rarely happens in the professional game.
I think it hasn't not happened.
Oh, no, it hasn't not happened.
Didn't Eric Dyer go for a shit that time?
He went off during a game. He was already on.
And didn't someone, who was the manager then, followed him in and said, are you all right? what's going on?
Yeah,
and I'm hoping it was Mourinho.
And they've got less. They've got less to think about than they used to. They don't have to do the oranges at half time, for instance.
No, but
do they?
I think it would be a step forward in substitute world if they had the bloody kit on. You know, if they were sat there with the shirt on, ready to, you'd feel ready to play then, wouldn't you?
Well, you know, in rugby, they quite often they're on exercise bikes and things like that. Yeah. You know, they're actually genuinely warming up rather than a hamstring. It's like all substitutes are terrified of hamstring injuries.
Yeah, but what this guy Sammy Lander says is, you know, that what he could have done, what could have happened with Rashford and Sancho is, you know, if he'd known that this was going to be a thing, that they were going to come on and take a penalty. With 5 minutes to go, you take them into a room and have them take some kicks,
so that
it's not like the first kick that they've taken.
And that's another thing that always baffles me is when, I mean, obviously, clearly there are far too many substitutes apart from anything else.
Well, they just announced that they're going to be more, aren't they? They're going to be going to go back up to five in the
out of
a benchful. Five out of seven, I think.
Yeah, I don't know what a benchful is. It's not a real number, a benchful, is it?
No, it's not.
But they tend to, at half-time, they'll go in and then they leave the subs out to muck about on the pitch.
Yeah.
You know, and it's only because the pitches are so good now, nobody's coming out going, not in the goal mouth! Come out of the goal mouth!
Or that they have to come out with those little forks.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, yeah, this is what Sammy Lander is talking about. He described a picture of Manchester United's bench the other way. Not that we're picking on Manchester United particularly, but they, there we are. But, exactly. But there were six or seven players, and they're slumped over, their arms folded, the hoods up. You know, you have to. He has to first combat the negative association with being on the bench in the first place.
Yeah.
No, but it doesn't have to be Man United. We've all seen those shots. Guys who are visibly bristling with resentment at being on the bench, and they haven't got over it halfway through the game.
And on their phone or laughing together.
Yeah. And he tries to engage players during the game, try to talk to them about what their opposite number is doing, or the guy they might have to replace.
Yeah.
And try to spot things they can exploit. Yeah. You know, and one of the things I thought was interesting was that the AFC Wimbledon's manager, Mark Robinson, has got this. This is a trial period for this thing.
Right.
And he's in two minds about it. On the one hand, it seems to make the players feel more valued, especially if they're worried about not starting.
Yeah.
No, but on the other hand, he quite reasonably believes that players ought to be grown up and professional enough to take responsibility for being properly prepared themselves.
Well,
and so the role ought to be... clearly he's a dreamer.
Yeah, that's a real step, isn't it, into the unknown, to tell you the honest truth? That's ridiculous. I mean, the other thing, I mean, you wonder... You know, I quite like this idea, I have to say.
Yeah, I quite like
it. You know, I mean, you could train them up to speak behind their hand, which is another thing that...
It's another skill that...
Skill.
Some of them just don't have.
They don't have it. You know, you see them there, mouths wide open, slagging people off, saying, you know, come on, boss, give me a go. That's not right. That's not what a substitute should do.
No, and when Ronaldo was a sub, he spent more time in the technical area shouting instructions than Solskjaer did, didn't he? So he's clearly engaged.
Yeah.
I mean, I sense, you know, that he's a Manager of the Month award in the offing.
I would have thought so. So what else do we think they could have? I mean, presumably demanding a yellow card coach, claiming a corner in ridiculous circumstances coach. Getting off the bus holding a little handbag coach. These are the sort of things that need to be coached.
They're skills and they need to be done right.
They need to be done right.
It's a question of training the muscle memory so that that's all.
That's right. If you brought Dave Brailsford in, these things would be done, would they not?
They would, absolutely.
And the drug thing.
I mean, I've long thought that in international football, when you have big squads, international tournament football is like a 14-man, 16-man game, depending on how many subs there are. 16-man, let's say. And sub, in that situation, should be a specialist position. Not necessarily someone that we've... to make a like-for-like thing.
No.
Someone that you can use to make a tactical change. I've always thought that was the great reason for having someone like... say Peter Crouch, if he wasn't your first choice, or Andy Carroll,
he's very
different to what you had.
Absolutely, and this is it not for those of us again old enough, which I'm going to presume is everybody. Why didn't they bring Dave Besant on for the penalties in the 1990 World Cup semi final? You know, Shilton had a terrible record saving penalties. Dave Besant had a great record.
That Tim Krul.
It did work for Tim Krul.
Did they ever tell you I played five-a-side against Dave Besant? Not against, with Dave Besant one time. In one of those tournaments where you get given it was a charity thing, you get given a pro to play with your team.
Yeah.
And Andy Smart was playing as well.
Yeah.
And we got we got to the final, and we got Dave Besant.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't let him play in goal because it wouldn't be fair. So he's playing outfield.
Yeah.
And this game was 15, 20 minutes, and it was 1-1. And Dave Besant's standing next to me, and he says, "What happens if this is a draw?" And I said, "Oh, I don't know, extra time, I think." Because it was the final.
Yeah.
Extra time, I think. And he went, "Oh, fuck that." And he stepped away from me, took the ball off whoever had it, beat all the other players and scored a goal. And it was like he could have done that at any moment.
Absolutely. And if you won the tournament, did you get to keep your professional? That would be a lovely thing. Anyway, we need to take a break now because in a moment we have our guest.
Lovely.
Our guest today is responsible for some of my absolute favourite visits to the world's football grounds, John O'Groats, and indeed East Africa. A passionate, uncompromising and incredibly successful manager who hasn't always been appreciated as much as he should. The go-to figure if you want to avoid relegation, transform your fortunes or increase the sale of merchandise in the club shop. It's Mr. Tony, Anthony Tony Pulis.
Nick.
I shouldn't call you Anthony because, of course, your son is traditionally Anthony, isn't
he? Oh, no, I'm an Anthony.
Yeah, oh, you're an Anthony.
Oh, yeah, mum wouldn't have no other word. When I started courting Debbie, you know, Deb would call me Tony and she'd... She'd pick Debbie up on it.
And call you Phony.
Oh, your mum would?
Yeah, mum would, yeah.
Yeah. You're phony for sure.
Phony.
Yeah. Absolutely. I'm going to ask you, it's quite a cliched question, but I'm always interested, and we generally get the same answer, but I'd be interested on your perspective on it. So, what would you choose, playing or managing?
I'll play in every minute.
Yeah, yeah.
Every minute of the day. I think playing is, management and coaching is secondary. By a country mile playing.
Yeah. So you stand on the touchline and think, oh, you still want to be out there?
No, you move on, don't you? Time moves on and you have to move on. If you want to be in this wonderful game that we've been in and been very fortunate to... Well, I've been in it for a long, long time and been very fortunate. You know, it's the next step. Mm-hmm. So you want to stay in it, so you take the next step. Mm-hmm. But playing is by far, Nick, the best of it all.
And first of all, who as a... youngster, because you went to Bristol, did you, as a youngster?
Yeah, I went to Bristol Rovers. I used to go and watch Newport and Cardiff. We used to jump on a train from Newport. It was one stop to Cardiff, Ninian Park. We went to Ninian Park the train and jump off and then try and nick off, Nick. We'd never pay for it. You know, there was about six or seven of us, and then we'd go and try and get in the Grange end. If I can remember right, we'd go right round the back where there was a rean, jump over the rean, and there was some corrugated iron fencing that we used to pull apart and nick in. And the money we'd been given by mum to go in, we'd buy a hot dog or a burger with it.
And of course, you've reimbursed Cardiff.
Of course.
I just wanted to get that absolutely, absolutely clear. And who were the players that stimulated you as a youngster?
Well, Toshack was there then.
Of course.
I know, it's years ago. Nobody listening to this is going to remember that, Nick, apart from me and you. Toshack, the lad Gibson in midfield. They were a good team. They just missed out. They actually sold Tosh to Liverpool and then brought Alan Warboys in.
Did they? Warboys and Bannister?
No, that was Bristol
Rovers. No, I know, but Smash and Grab. Yeah, that was what they were called, wasn't
it? So there was a... Yeah, it was good there. Newport were different. Newport were in a lower league, obviously, and at a different level. But, you know, there was still... I'd still go over there. And if we could, if we could get in, then we'd go and watch, the county
and
play.
And that was obviously just a little bit before the Great Cup Winners' Cup run that they had with Aldridge and Tynan and all those. You'd have been playing then, presumably.
Yeah. No, well, I was playing, but I never played in the team then. But they had a really good team then. Yeah, very, very good team.
Yeah. So, about management. So... You go to Bournemouth.
Yeah.
Did you finish playing at Bournemouth?
Yeah. What happened was I went to Bournemouth with Harry. I think it was 3 years with H. And then I went to Gillingham and played a year at Gillingham.
Did you?
But I had a real bad injury. And then Harry brought me back as a coach. So I went back to Bournemouth as a coach. And then worked under him for a year and then took the manager's job. That was 92, I think, the first manager's job. Okay. So that was a long time ago.
Okay.
So I went from playing to coaching.
So that was just after
management.
The famous FA Cup win.
H was, that was a couple of years before we got there. I think that was eight. I went in 86, 87. We actually won the league that year. Mm-hmm. So they got into the championship for the first time for a long, long time. If you want to spend a couple of hours talking about Harry, then I've more than enough stories.
Now, what I really wanted to ask you about was your managerial style. And it's such a cliche to say you're a family, but I know family man, but I know how important family is to you and how close you are and how protective you feel about them. But it always seemed to me when you were at Stoke that one of the things that you tried to engender was that same sense of
of loyalty as a group. And I just wanted to know, would you put that ahead of everything?
Well, you go back to, you know, your young years when you're being, you know, talking about school time and primary school and secondary school. I was brought up down the docks in South Wales. It was a very, very close-knit community. You know, everything that people have forgot about happened there. You know, people were together. You know, you live next door. That most of the families in our street, in Dolphin Street, you know, there was a three-bedroom terraced house. There was eight of us living in there, four boys in one room, the two girls in the other room, and mum and dad in the box room. And that was the same for most of the people in that street. When, you know, people used to have big families. If you run out of milk, you'd knock next door and, you know, you'd borrow half a pint of milk off the neighbour. And if something happened next door or one of the neighbours fell on hard times, you'd look after them. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't be left, Nick. They'd be looked after. So that community, that togetherness, right from a young age, was inbred, really. And that's what, you know, like I say, South Wales, obviously, my dad worked in the steelworks, with the mines and the steelworks. Everybody, you know, it was tough and it was hard. But I thought I had a wonderful time. It's only when you move away from it, you look back and you think, God blimey, did I live through that?
Yeah.
But at the time, Nick, I thought it was wonderful.
Yeah.
And I took a lot of my DNA really was grown in that period up until I left to go to Bristol.
So do you think that reflects in people not liking people who don't pull their weight, expecting people to show up for other people, you know, to cover them, if you like, literally on the pitch?
I just think everything, the community was a community. It was a very, very working class area. You know, we had the trains coming down from the docks at the bottom of our street, bringing the coal down to the docks. We had the steelworks two streets away. My father never, ever drove a car. He was always on a pushbike all the way through our lives, so we never had any of that. You had nothing, Nick, but you had everything.
Yeah.
You know, never, ever, ever thought that I was short of anything in my life as a kid.
And how do you think that transfers then into your management style? When you're trying to shape a group of players and you want them to all be pulling in the same direction and you know what you want of them.
I put that over everything else.
Yeah.
I think trying to make a football club a family, trying to bring everybody together as a family, whether, you know, that you bring the wives in and get the wives involved, get the children involved, but making sure that everybody appreciates your management. And I think what you've got to do as a manager, you know, it's a very lonely job at times.
Yeah.
And what you've got to do, you've got to convince those players that what you're saying, what you're doing and the way you're working will lead to success. And to do that, you definitely have to drop lots of rules down and set targets and set standards. And if the players stay in that, you know, in that set of rules, and aspire to the standards you're looking for, brilliant. If they don't, you have to get rid of them.
Right.
Because if you want to be successful, you can't be carrying too many people around.
Yeah. No, well, you must be also managing players who, as you say, you've had a particular working class upbringing yourself at the docks and so on, and your dad on the pushbike.
Yeah.
You know, but you're dealing with young men who are getting a lot very young, are lifted out of that, if you like, very young. So you have to, I suppose, be prepared to make sure that they understand that.
Well,
the world doesn't revolve around them. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
that's
what
they're told.
If you look at it, when I started management at Bournemouth in '92, the players' wages and the managers' wages were very, very close to the working class person outside of football. You know, the extreme now, it's just, you know, professional footballers, you know, Premier League players, Championship players, they live in a bubble. It's just a complete and utter bubble. They're not aware of what happens outside that bubble.
Of the value of things.
Of the value
system that you're trying to put together.
And I think it's very, very important that if you don't manage, everything moves on. Society moves on, and if you don't manage at the level of society and the way it is, then you're going to fall down, because you'll end up having argument after argument after. Mm-hmm. So you have to give and take a little bit more, and you have to understand where it's going, and you have to manage around that. But there's certain principles I've never ever moved away from, and never will move away from. I understand, you know, all the problems and all the stuff that social media has brought, you know, to the game in respect of individually with players, mm-hmm. with criticism managers get, with the criticism the chairman or the clubs will get if the results are not good. You have to understand that. You have to accept it because it's life. But you have to deal with it.
And it's harder to ignore that sort of level of contact, isn't it?
Yeah, I just think that if you want to be in the game and you want to be part of it, then, and especially at the top level where the rewards are just extraordinary, mm-hmm. then you've got to accept that criticism. I think there's a limit, and it has to be managed better than what it is at the moment. I think mm-hmm. the you know, some of the stuff on the social media is totally unacceptable. But we can't change that within football. That's got to be the government. That's got to be the people who run the sites, and the government have got to change
and
that.
And education.
But even with education, Nick, I think, you know, it's like talking about rules and you set your rules, and if people break those rules, they've got to be punished. Mm-hmm. And that actually, I think, is what we're not doing at the moment and what mm-hmm. we have to do.
We had Don Goodman in the other week, and we were talking about the key performance indicators and all those sorts of things. You know, the way that players...
Can you explain that to me?
Yeah, well, no. We were talking about it. We didn't understand it, as with nearly everything we talk about. But we were talking about, you know, signing players. And, of course, there's one question there anyway, which is how much autonomy do managers have over signing players? And that's changing. But the other thing is, I know you've said to me before about, you know, it's important to know what a player's going to be like in the dressing room.
Yep.
Now, the key performance indicators, that's easy to understand how you can find that. When you're looking at a player, how do you find out what you need to know about them as a person and how you imagine they'll be in the dressing room?
Well, I think if you spend enough time, and I was lucky enough and fortunate to be at Stoke for a long time, what you do, you bring in characters who are building blocks. So they make everything around the football club solid.
Yeah.
And then you can bring one or two Herberts in if you need, who are gonna improve it and give it a little bit more quality along the way. But what you must never do is go away from having that rock solid backbone of a football club. If you do that and you bring more of the other type in, then the castle falls down without a question of a doubt. So you've got to build a structure with good people. You know, life, the longer you go on in life and the longer, you know, the older I get, you understand that life's about good people. Uh-huh. Forget all the rest of the stuff that flies around. If you're dealing and being around good people, you know, you'll enjoy your life.
So would it be difficult, do you think, to take over a job with the style that you have and the priorities that you have, a job where you're like just the head coach and you're presented with a group of players?
Well, I think the game's changed, and you have to accept now everybody's got directors of football or chief scouts or this, that and the other. The only thing I'd say is that if you've got these directors of football and you've got these people picking players, if the results don't go and the manager gets sacked, then that fella should go with the manager. I think it'd certainly liven him up a bit. Liven him up a bit.
Well,
if the results are not good enough and the manager gets sacked and then he goes, that would change everything.
Yeah, well, and that's the situation at the club. The club that I follow is Oldham Athletic.
Yeah, yeah.
And at the moment, they've got the owner's brother is the sporting director, and so the managers carry the can all the time because he's not going to sack his older brother.
It's not an ideal situation, and
I had a situation at Stoke, and I'm not saying this is definitely what happened, but we played Shrewsbury Town in the cup, and Gary Rowett was under a lot of pressure and he wasn't being moved, and then there was suddenly a song about getting rid of the chief executive, and Gary Rowett went the next week. So,
yeah. Well, that's what I mean. I just think that you know, there's certain things that I think have to come into football. I think there's a lot of young managers now coming into the game, and it's management is so difficult, and it's more difficult now than it's ever been. I always wanted more experienced people with me. I had Jerry Francis, Kempe, people like that.
Reid.
Yeah, Reid. Always, they were more experienced than me, older than me. And I was more comfortable with people who'd seen things before. You know, it took me 3 meetings to get Jerry to come to Stoke when we got promoted. But he was vital to us because he'd experienced it, he'd understood. And although he only came in 2 days a week and watched the game on a Saturday, you know, his input was massive. Kempe had worked at Wimbledon. you know, he'd worked at Crystal Palace. He knew all about the Premier League. I didn't. So to have those people around you, if you have a look at it today, I think managers or coaches now, it's not managers, coaches come in and they're almost given people, yeah, you know, to work with. And, mm-hmm, and if I was a young coach today and given the opportunities to manage the Premier League, would I get a younger coach in? No, I'd get someone in who would manage up. Because, yeah, I think managing up now is more important than managing or having a coach who can work on the pitch for you.
So just to ask, I mean, just to go back to the dressing room thing, and I accept you do not want a Herbert-heavy dressing room, do you? You want a Herbert-light dressing room. But what are some of the more disappointing, appalling, shocking...
That's just the name I use. I'm not being disrespectful to people. But I think the... You know, I think it's talking about building a football club, and there's people you'd give, you know, that long-term contracts to, who you know their characters are spot on, and week in, week out, irrespective of how the results are going to go, they're going to stand up for you. And, you know, Alex Stock used to say, when I was just a young kid, when you stood at that door and those players are walking out the dressing room to play a game of football, you want to be looking at men, not boys. Mm-hmm. And that always stuck with me. But you can have one or two players. And I used to say they're players maybe two or three windows worth. Mm-hmm. And then once you've had them for two or three windows, your effect will drop off. It's like that, you know, shouting at people all the time or the dog barking at you. Yeah, eventually, yeah, it drops off. So you use them and get them out. The ones like the ones we're talking about, Shawcross, Delap, Walters, people like that, and I could name... Stoke, they don't move. You keep them there, whatever happens, and irrespective of who comes
the
in
spine
from.
Of your...
they are where the club wants to be.
And
you can fill it. You can fill it up with, you know, Matty Etherington was fabulous. He was one of my favourite players. Pennant was a 2-3 window player. Mm-hmm. You know, he could come in, Jermaine, and he could do stuff that we couldn't do, but. Over a period of time, it would wear off, and that was Jermaine's character. Yeah, that was his character, nothing else.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was, you know, he was good for us when we were at Stoke. Yeah. So that, you know, it's building a picture of a group of players who can go out and win football matches. Mm-hmm. You know, people ring me up today, or young managers, you know, about philosophies and this, that, and the other. And I'll say, yeah, brilliant, absolutely fabulous. But don't forget one thing. If you don't win football matches, irrespective of your philosophy is, you ain't going to be around long.
No. And that was Alex Stock, was it, who said you want to be looking at men, not boys?
Yeah, Alex. Yeah. Alex,
good,
was,
good advice for the internet
When I was a young lad at Bournemouth, I wasn't him. He was in an old-age people's home at the bottom of the road in Wimborne. I used to pop in once or twice a week just to see him.
Alex Stock?
Yeah, right. And he had a greenhouse. They built him a greenhouse. And Alex had been in at El Alamein. He'd fought with Montgomery and everything else. So he was a very upstanding fella. Always had a tie on, you know, really old-fashioned, you know, British-type person. And he used to come out with some gems, absolute gems. And, yeah, that was one of his...
He the prototype of Paul Whitehouse's run manager character?
Alex Stock.
But he was jumpers for goalposts.
Yeah, he was an absolute fabulous man. Yeah, and great standards, you know, really, really great standards.
And just to talk, you're talking about Britishness there, and the way that the English leagues work. When foreign managers come in, it's quite different. You told me, and you might even not remember this, an incredible story about Louis van Gaal talking to you after you'd won at Old Trafford with West Brom.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I got on with most of the foreign managers. I used to have Wenger was, you know, he was a little bit tetchy, but that was because we always beat him at the Britannia.
Yeah.
And even when I went to West Brom and Palace, I think we beat Arsenal. So we had something over, or I managed to have something over Arsenal. The rest of them are really, really good people. And I've found them interesting. And I've found them very outgoing in a lot of ways, Nick. But I think the game, again, you talk about the change. The game's changed in respect. There's a lot of foreign owners now. And with foreign owners come foreign agents. And foreign agents will know foreign managers or foreign coaches more than they'll know English coaches. I think the one great sadness for me, there's two things, is the fact that, you know, that managers can do well in the lower leagues now and not get the recognition. Mm. And unless they get a team promoted, they're going to be very, very lucky. Unless you're a name, you know, Frank did it at Derby and got the Chelsea job on the back of what he'd done as a player at Chelsea. So unless you're doing that, then I think, you know, that avenue, that pathway to managing. We talked about Jim Smith and Ron Atkinson and people like that who never played at the top level.
No.
But got their chance of working at mm-hmm. the top level because they'd managed so well down. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's unfortunately, that's gone away.
But in terms of the competitiveness of the Premier League, I think Van Gaal was amazed when you went there with West Brom.
Yeah, I know his big thing was that he didn't find one game in the Premier League easy. He thought every team, whereas abroad, you could play in Dutch football, you could play in other football, and you could go to places and know we're going to win. And he said in England, every game that we play, every challenge that's put in front of us is a proper challenge. Mm-hmm. And you can't take that away from this league, mm-hmm. and that's why, you know, it's great viewing, Nick, and why it's the greatest league in the world.
Mm-hmm. But was he quite exasperated by that?
Yeah, he was saying it through clenched teeth. But no, you know, like I say, Nick, he's been a top manager and he's worked with some fabulous coaches, players. Sorry,
and. I'm thinking of Ricardo Fuller, but there must be other players like that. And you were talking about as long as you have your building blocks, you can have people around it. The decoration, if you like, the side orders, whatever you want. And I know sometimes you found managing players like that frustrating, but you appreciate what they give to you. And which players would you put in that category?
Well, Ricardo was the worst by a country mile. You know, he was, you know, one of the best players. We signed him for 200 grand from Southampton. And you know, we signed him on the back of him having a dodgy knee as well. He walked in, he limped into the ground when we signed him. But he was just an amazing player. He was a player who could do something create something out of nothing. And me and Kempy's coming over tomorrow from America, David Kemp, who was my assistant. And I don't know Kempy always says, I'd love a pound for every time you'd say after 60 minutes, get Rick off. He's doing absolutely nothing. And then in that last 30 minutes, win you a game of football. Mm-hmm. He could just light something up, Nick.
I've seen him
absolutely,
do it.
Yeah. From absolutely nothing. He was technically a top player. Mm-hmm. As a character, he was difficult, but difficult in a good way. I don't think he was nasty.
No.
I don't think he had any badness in him at all.
Yep, yeah, but he had his own international breaks, didn't he?
Well, I've told the story. I'll tell it for you again. We're playing. I think we're second in the league with about six games to go, and we go to Wolves, and it's just on. We play at home against someone. We beat someone at home, and we're 3 or 4 points ahead now, I think, or whatever, or 2 or 3 points. We play Wolves on the following fortnight, so there's a 2 week break. So Rick comes and sees me and says, you know, he's going off to Jamaica. They got a game and all. So this was on the Thursday, or he put his form in to the secretary. So we're looking. I said to Kemp, have a look who Jamaica are playing because we need Rick back for this game. We couldn't find a fixture for Rick. We looked absolutely everywhere, and we couldn't find a fixture. Jamaica. You know, so I pull him on the after the game. You haven't got a fixture, Rick. There's no gaff. He used to say gaff. There's a game. There's a game. I can't remember who it is, but there's a game. But I promise you, I'll be back in on the Monday. So I'll have a full week before the Wolves game. So, okay. Off he goes. Don't hear from him. We turn up on the Monday. Most of the lads are back. Obviously, we're preparing, you know, the opportunity and chance of getting in the Premiership and everything else. So we're preparing that week for Wolves. Mick McCarthy was manager. Their Wolves are flying. It was going to be a full house. I think we'd sold about 5,500 tickets to go to the game. Yeah, it was just a very, very important game for us. Monday, no Ricardo. Tuesday, no Ricardo. So I say to Dave, get on to him, Dave. Make sure he's in Thursday. Wednesday off, make sure he's in Thursday. Couldn't get hold of him. Thursday comes, no Ricardo. Friday, we managed to get him, and he says, I think Rick's one of the reasons was that he got stopped in Miami and then he had to go back to Jamaica to get some visa or whatever that would allow him to be back in. That was his, but he didn't come in until Saturday morning. So we've had a full week of training and preparation. Rick's not turned up. So on Saturday morning, we have pre-match at the ground. We didn't do it very often, but because Wolves was only 35 minutes away, we went and had pre-match. We all got together beforehand, got the players, had whatever we had upstairs in the Brit, or about 365 Stadium now. Had something to eat. Even that, he's late for. He walks in, you know, at past 11, you're supposed to be there. He walked in about quarter to 12, whatever. He had a baseball hat on the side of his head. He, you know, he's dragging his leg, his wooden leg along. So he's, you know, morning to the players, and, you know, all the lads are blanking him. They don't have nothing to do with him. He's completely custard pied us, all the group and everything else. We talked about how close the team was and what a great spirit it was. He walks down, gets his eggs and beans, sticks it on a bit of toast, and he sits on a table by himself. So he knows he's out of order. Yeah. So anyway, that the lads, Dave Watson shouting the lads to get on the bus. Me and Kempy are still having a cup of tea, having a chat about this, that and the other. So I say to Kempy, I'm not going to play him. So he says, yeah, no, I don't blame you. He says, but stick him on the bench. I said, Kempy, do you think he deserves to be on the bench? Forget about does he deserve it. Let's sort that out afterwards. Put him on the bench. So I'll think about it. So he walks past. He says, hello, Gaff. So I go, hello, Rick. Nice of you to turn up, mate. So he goes, big smile. Yeah, we're going to win today. Off he goes, drags his leg through the thing and downstairs and sits by himself on the bus. Nobody to talk to him. Go in the dressing room. We get the lads ready for the game. I think we go 1-0 up. And then it goes 1-1, 2-1. And then Liam scores a great goal to make it 2-2. Or Rory might have scored, or Mama scored. One of the. Anyway, the game's 2-2. And Wolves are kicking down the slope now. There's about 20 minutes to go. And they are murdering us. There's balls coming in left, right and centre. And the lads, we had Ryan and Courty.
Oh, Courty, Liam, yeah, Courty. Liam.
Courty, yeah. At the back, heading balls, you know, heading battleships out of the water. They're just smashing them on the head and everything else. So Kempy turns to me and he says, time to bring him on. And I said, time to bring him on? I said, Kempy can walk straight. I said, I don't know what he's been doing. He just looks shot away. He said, get him warmed up. So I said, Rick, go and get warmed up. So he's got to run up that little slope. So he run about 20 yards and then walked up the top. So he couldn't make it up the top of this little hill. So he's up there and he's doing little stretches talking to the Wolves supporters. So I'm looking at him. I'm going absolutely berserk inside. And I mean berserk. I'm thinking after the game, he's getting it. So as he walks down, Kempy goes, get him on. I'm telling you, we need someone who's going to light this game up. Put him on. Corner comes in. I think Ryan heads it away. Rick chests it on the side of the box near the dugout. He dribbles down, beats two players, smashes it in the back of the net. Unbelievable. He sprints, the fastest I've ever seen him sprint in my life. Right down the pitch, high-fiving. All the players are jumping on him. He's high-fiving everybody. We end up winning the game 4-2. So I come in, I'm absolutely drenched in sweat and everything else. I take my cap off and I sit in the corner. I've said, well done, lads. Fantastic result. Brilliant. Really deserve this. So I sit in the corner and all of a sudden he gets up and I can see him out of the corner of my eye coming over. And he walks over and he sits, and still the players, you know, they're all over him now. He's the hero. Comes, puts his hand around me, goes, Gaff. He says, you worry too much. So I went to bite his head off and he went, and that's why you've got no hair. And he just got up and walked across the dressing room to the other side. And that was Rick.
Yeah.
Rick. Yeah. And we pulled him Monday and he had all the excuses under the sun. Kempy said, you know, we've got video footage of four coats down on the beach in Jamaica and you playing in that rig. And he went, yeah, most probably.
Yeah, change is as good as a rest, isn't it?
Yeah. I think he scored two.
Yeah, he got the two goals.
Yeah. Tony, thank you so much. I hope you come back another time. That was great. Lovely to see you. Thanks very much, Tony.
Brilliant. Pulis. Thank you, lads.
So thanks very much to Tony, and send your emails into slopingpitch@gmail.com. Subscribe to the podcast if you possibly could. Rate and review us if you like. You can give the show 5 stars. And to be honest, and I don't like to beg, it's looking like we're not going to survive. So just tell lots of people to subscribe to it. It's free and we get free water. So please listen to us next week and tell everybody else to.
GreatBigOwl.com. Social Podcast Network.